Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi, dhammaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi, saṅghaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi. Dutiyampi buddhaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi, dutiyampi dhammaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi, dutiyampi saṅghaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi. Tatiyampi buddhaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi, tatiyampi dhammaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi, tatiyampi saṅghaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi. Okay, I almost forgot to get my watch, which keeps me accountable so I don't go over time. Okay, here we go. So nice to see everybody here today. And today was kind of interesting day for me. There's a friend of mine who we grew up together as young kids. And he was a few years older than me. He's a very kind of big guy. And we used to play games together. He was always very strong, you know. And he lives in Brampton now. So about once a year, we always have this joke that we have a kind of classic, which is me kind of saying, hey, let's go for a walk. And then he always jokes. He's like, yeah, let's go on one of our walks where we're walking and, you know, I'm totally exhausted. And you're looking at me like, come on, there's 10 more miles to go. But it was nice to see him, and you know, we got together today and said hello. He's a Christian, and we get along pretty well. Had a kind of common interest in video games, and not that I can play those anymore. But you know, we were together, kind of walking around for a good chunk of time. Maybe actually, he picked me up at like 1, and we went for a walk here in Colonel Danforth Park, and so we were maybe together for like 4 hours, you know. Hadn't seen him for maybe more than a year, about a year and a half, and just talking and catching up on things. And he seems to be doing pretty well for anybody who's interested. But the interesting thing about this is, you know, you're kind of out walking and talking, you know, and you know, it's all fine, nothing too crazy. But essentially, during this time, you know, kind of walking and talking, kind of what it can be is sending our minds outwards, you know. So I mean, it was kind of like 5 hours, 4 hours. It was nice, you know, get together with my friend and talk with him. But all these things have a kind of effect, you know, kind of on our minds when we go to sit down to meditate. So, you know, during meditation, you know, you might notice, okay, telling my mind, okay, you know, do this. And it's, you know, a little bit less obedient than maybe I'd like, you know. Like, okay, you know, time to stay with the breath right now, but I just spent, you know, maybe 4 hours, like sitting, you know, talking and cracking jokes and all these things, and it's still in the talking and, you know, cracking jokes mode. You know? So this is a kind of, you know, kind of interesting thing. You know, kind of the Buddha has this metaphor, kind of a mind being like a pool of water. You know? And when we send our mind outwards to grab onto all these various things, you know, then it's like stirring the water up. You know, so we kind of send our mind out to kind of things that make us angry. You know, so kind of we were walking and this topic of like a politics came up, you know, which is the kind of thing that people commonly talk about. But often people talking about politics can get like really angry, you know. Go, this is the new policy that Doug Ford is putting in place. You know, so I can't, he told me two that I can't remember off the top of my head, but I think one of them was that he's getting rid of the electric vehicle rebate. So my friend was going to buy an electric vehicle rebate. And so then, you know, if you think about that, you know, and you're not leaning in that political, monks are apolitical, by the way, but, you know, if you're not leaning in that political direction, you'd be like, well, this, you know, Doug Ford's taking away the electric car rebate. Now we're going to have all these gas guzzlers. It's going to destroy the environment. And then, you know, sending our mind out like this, you know, it stirs up the water, you know? And it kind of also, you know, another thing that stirs up the water is these thoughts, what they call kind of like more like sensual thoughts, kind of thoughts on these things that, you know, we really want to have, you know? So probably several times during the conversation, these thoughts of a domino, you were talking about Domino's pizza. the topic of Domino's pizza came up several times, you know. And, you know, not like it's terrible to be talking about Domino's pizza if you're, I mean, my friend is not a Buddhist, so, you know, we can't really, you know, we can discuss some things in common, but, you know, we knew each other when we were kids, and this is the kind of thing that you talk about with your friends. So these Domino's pizza came up, and this talk about kind of like they have these Parmesan balls, apparently, that I've never eaten. And it's like, oh, you remember those bocce bits from Pizza Pizza where they, you know, they make them and they'd be all greasy, you put them in the thing, each one has like 800 calories. It's like, well, now they've got these Parmesan balls at Domino's. And then driving down the road, we saw like 3 or 4 Domino's. They were probably always there, but I just never noticed them. Start talking about Domino's and all of a sudden, you know, bocce bits are on the mind and all of a sudden Domino's are everywhere. And this is kind of another thing that, you know, can stir up the mind, kind of sending our mind out to thoughts of Domino's, thoughts of, you know, bocce bits and Parmesan balls, you know. And of course, another thing that can stir up our mind is these kind of thoughts of restlessness and agitation, kind of things that we should be doing that we haven't done, things that really need to get done, you know, right now so that our mind can't settle down right away. You know, so often, of course, these are things often that are legitimate things that we need to consider. So talking with him, and obviously how's the thing, actually, I don't have to worry about this much, but he does, and kind of talk about the housing market. Okay, you know, if houses now are really expensive and he has step kids, there's like, we have to think about, you know, where we're gonna put the step kids. Are they gonna be able to buy a house? What kind of big house are we going to need in the future so that maybe they can live on ground level and we can live on the top? And all these things are, you know, thoughts about what we should do, right? It kind of pulls us away, and they're important. I mean, he's got to think about those things. You know? I less so, not having any kids and never planning to own a house. As long as you stay a monk, you don't need to trouble yourself with those things. But legitimate thoughts. And yet, you know, sitting around, we talk about those for an hour or whatever, 30 minutes, and sit down to meditate, and our mind's going out to thoughts about the house. Where are my kids going to be in, you know, 10 years, right? Where am I going to be? I've got to retire. Spent a lot of time talking about kind of jobs and this kind of thing. This is another kind of thing that pulls our mind out. And then before we finished our conversation, we got to talking about religion. You know, he's a Christian, I'm a Buddhist, so he's like, you know, what do Buddhists do? What do monks do during the day? It's kind of a common question that I get, you know, quite a lot. So usually I tell people, well, you know, we're like a preacher. You know, just think about like a priest or a preacher. There's probably a lot of overlap. You know? But, you know, talking about these religions, comparative philosophies, and they're very different. Kind of, they have overlap, Christianity and Buddhism, you know, Buddhism and Hinduism, Buddhism and Islam, Christianity and Islam, there's overlap, you know, there's similarities between these things, but there's also, you know, there's genuine differences between the religions, which is why people make genuine choices about which philosophy they're going to follow. And so these kind of things come up in our heads, and if we think about them incorrectly, it can give rise to doubt. Kind of, well, am I really doing the right thing here? You know, like, there's this totally different philosophy. The people there, are they happier? Do the people there seem like more successful in their life? Are the Christians richer? Are they, is God blessing them? They have all this wealth, you know? Are the Buddhists more peaceful? They seem, you know, do they seem more peaceful? Is that because their philosophy's right and mine's wrong? And these are legitimate, important things to consider, right? You know? I mean, we have to have a philosophy that guides us. You know, if we don't have a philosophy that guides us, then we run out to bocce bits. You know, that's our philosophy, right? Kind of bocce bits, Parmesan balls, Domino's pizza. We don't have an overriding philosophy that's larger than that, then we live our life for the sake of, you know, bocce bits and Parmesan balls. And so we have to consider this. And yet, attending to these things inappropriately gives rise to a lot of doubt. You know, whether we're following the right path, you know, whether, do I have the right religion? Actually, I know in Korea, I started in Korean Buddhism, and many Koreans were actually converted because they saw Buddhism as backwards and Christianity as being very modern. And kind of, so it was a partially an economic consideration. Kind of all the Christians who were coming there were very wealthy and all the Buddhists were not. And, you know, their country had previously been Buddhist and it was considered backwards. And so many converted to Christianity, probably not just on that basis, but a large consideration was that it was modern. And here in the West, it was a Christian nation, and Buddhism is considered very modern. Kind of very advanced psychology. And Christianity, by some people who convert, this is not trying to impugn Christianity, just people's perceptions, is seen as something kind of very old, with like old psychological, old psychological models, kind of backwards way of thinking, you know? And so all these things give rise to doubt in people's minds. And when we send our mind outwards to things like this, these are things that we need to consider. I mean, we need to consider what we're going to eat. We have to consider this aspect of sensual pleasure. You know? We need to consider, you know, what we're going to do if we're lay people about our job, about our kids tomorrow, you know? About all these things. They're legitimate things we have to consider. You know? And we have to consider about politicians, because living in a democracy, it's actually the responsibility of people living here to make informed choices about their political leaders. She kind of have to do it, you know? And that's the way society is structured. You know? Have to consider about our religions. And because we all need an overriding philosophy. You know, we don't just what we do is actually tends to be based on what the Buddha calls views, you know? And we tend to hold a view in the back of our head, even if we're secular humanists. And that view actually influences almost all the actions we take. This overriding philosophy. A person is a secular humanist, and that influences their whole life, their whole trajectory of their life. So it's something we have to consider. But what the Buddha talks about is that there's wise ways to consider things and unwise ways to consider things. So what he uses is this word, yoniso manasikara, and ayoniso manasikara. It's kind of, yoniso manasikara means like appropriate attention. You attend to things in an appropriate way. And ayoniso manasikara means attending to things in an inappropriate way. So living out in the world, you know, actually as a monk, this is one of the reasons why we become monks, is because we can we can focus almost all of our energies on Buddhist practice, which is something that's very beneficial, trying to move forward in Buddhist practice. But if we're not monks, as lay people, then this faculty, this ability to attend appropriately is something that's really, really important. Right? We all come to meditation looking for peace of mind. Right? We want our minds to be peaceful. We want our minds to be easeful. But what it means is that when attending to the ways of the world, we have to attend to them in a way that's appropriate. Attend to them in a way that's balanced. Attend to them in a way that's in line with the Dhamma. You know? So regarding food, you know, this is something that a lot of people in society have problems with. You know, kind of there's diet clinics, you know, where you've got your serious, like, you know, pay thousands of dollars to get advice from a dietitian about eating properly, right? So we have to learn, you know, when we practice, we learn to attend appropriately to food. Learn to attend appropriately to the things that are tantalizing, you know, to things outside that are, you know, we have to deal with, right? That are important to deal with. But there's always a crossover point for these things, right? So with food, you know, we have to eat it to live, but there's a crossover point where we keep eating food, and instead of being something that helps us, it actually becomes something that hurts us, right? With politics, I mean, I don't, as monks, we don't deal, but lay people deal. It's something that people have to deal with. We keep dealing with politics, keep talking about political issues. There's a point where it's beneficial, and then there's a crossover point where it becomes something negative, yeah? Something that obsesses our mind, you know? with our thinking about what's the right path for us to take, what's the right philosophy for us to have. There's a point where we think about it, it's beneficial, and then there can be a tipping point where it just gives rise to excessive doubt in our mind, kind of cripples us and hinders us, you know? It makes us kind of think all the time about philosophy and not actually, you know, do anything. Can be paralyzing, right? Same thing with thinking about our mortgages, our restlessness and remorse. And we have to, there's a certain point where we have to think about, what am I going to do in 10 years with my money? And there's a point where it's beneficial. And then there's a tipping point where it goes from being beneficial to being something that worries us, as something that obsesses us, something that makes us restless to get more money, to try to get a security that we can't lock onto. So he seems to be receding into the distance. And so the cure to these things isn't necessarily like a formula that the Buddha wrote down, right? Where it's like, okay, two parts mortgage thinking, one part, bhavana meditation. You know, one part of the conversation like this, one part of the conversation like that. What it is, though, is something that we can gain a skill in, you know, something that we have to notice. So this is why the Buddha says, you know, even if we're not skilled in reading other people's minds, then we have to become skilled in reading our own minds. You know? Because this is one of the main things that we develop skill in with our meditation practice. We develop skill in with directing our mind, is knowing where these tipping points are. When are we on the side of cultivating wholesome qualities? Right? When are we on the side where it's starting to get unwholesome? And this is where the trick is. This is what makes it difficult. It's also what makes it a skill. It's also what makes it liberating. Because it's something that we can develop. You know, it's not something that was written in stone that can only happen when conditions are a particular way. It's not the case that we can only make our mind settle down into concentration in a particular way. It's not the case that we can only learn to cultivate good qualities when everything is arranged just perfect in a particular way. Yeah? It is the case that there's this variety of conditions, and if we attend to them appropriately, we build our conditions appropriately, we manipulate the conditions outside appropriately, then we can create something wholesome, even when almost everything around us seems unwholesome. So there is this opportunity there, but where there's opportunity, there's also a responsibility, right? Because although there's this opportunity, what it also means is that we can't just totally follow, right? So this was one of the questions, actually, after leaving my friend, a guy stopped me in the park, and he said, so, you know, I don't mean to be offensive, but like, what do Buddhists do? Do they like pray to Buddha? Or like, what is he? Is he a god? Or what is he, you know? And so I didn't get into the whole thing, but I said, we, the Buddha is our teacher. And being a skilled teacher, it's not the case that the Buddha can just tell us, do step A, step B, step C, and step D will always be the result. But as a skilled teacher, what he does is he turns us back on ourselves. And it says, you have to develop this skill for yourself. So actually, I know in Canadian culture, they would send their young men, once they'd taught them all the requisite skills, they would just turn them out into the wilderness on what they called the vision quests. And then it was up to them to use the skills that they'd learned, you know, use the practical skills that they'd learned and turn them into surviving in the wilderness alone, you know, for a while. When they came back from that vision quest, they had they'd become adults in the eyes of the community, but they also gained a kind of confidence in themselves that these skills, these techniques that I put to use, I now know how to adapt them appropriately. I know how to use them to make myself survive. So in other words, they had this opportunity, they had all these skills, but it's also a responsibility. They learned that they could take care of themselves with ease. You know? And so the Buddha teaches us in the same way. You know, as a skilled teacher, can't reach into our minds and make us develop yonaso manasikara ourself, make us have appropriate attention ourself. Yeah? All of us are the owners of our action. We're born of our action. We're heirs to our action. We abide supported by our actions. Yeah? Whatever our actions we do, We're the ones who inherit the results of those actions. And so what that means is there's always an opportunity, as long as we have our minds, to develop wholesome actions. Even on our deathbed, even at the last moment of our life, we can develop the Buddha's path. There's nothing that can stop us from doing that, so long as we have, you know, the right intentions and we don't have a previous karma obstruction, we're not brain dead. As long as we have the ability to make intentions, we have that capability. But it also comes with a responsibility. And that happiness, and that this appropriate attention, and that finding the right balance isn't something that's necessarily going to jump out at us, right? Finding the right amount to stop talking about the mortgage, you know, stop going to Domino's Pizza too much, right? Stop worrying about the kids too much. It's not something that will just jump out at us and prove itself to us. Like, okay, meditation, okay, Buddha, prove yourself to me. Make me happy. Here I am. You could sit back, right? It's a responsibility. It's something that's available to us to cultivate, but it's something that we have to make a reality for ourselves. We ourselves have to find out where is this tipping point between what's skillful and what's unskillful. We ourselves have to find out what is it that makes my mind calm. We ourselves are the ones who have to sit down, meditate ourselves, focus on our breath. We ourselves are the ones who have to keep the precepts, who have to resist doing things that are unwholesome and to do things that are wholesome. And we ourselves are the ones who inherit the results of that. We're the inheritors of that. We're the owners of our karma. We're born of our karma. We're related to our karma. We abide supported by our karma. And our karma is our true relative. So this is something that we all do together. Of course, we sit down to meditate. We listen to Dhamma talks. We read the Buddhist teachings about how to develop these skills. But at the end of the day, it's something that we know in our own minds. And so it was an interesting thing, this fellow, you know, who I was talking to at the end of the day, he was like, so, you know, what are Buddhists striving for? And I was like, well, you know, we're striving for Nibbana. I can't remember his exact words, but he's like, what, sum up Buddhism in a sentence. I was like, well, I don't know. How do I do that? I don't know. And so he asked me a series of other questions, and it came down to, okay, we're looking for the end of suffering, and that's Nibbana, you know? And he was like, oh, you know, that makes sense to me. He was like, well, can you describe it? And I was like, well, no, the Buddha says it's something that's beyond description and beyond words. And he said, well, you know, that makes sense to me. And he actually told me a metaphor that was really interesting. I'd never heard before. And he said, you know, it sounds just like that metaphor. It's like a dragonfly, you know? A dragonfly starts off in the water as this kind of little nymph, call it. And then when it, you know, grows, it metamorphosizes, it goes and it flies in the air. And he says, you know, that dragonfly can't change back into the nymph and go tell its, you know, its old nymph friends, you know, this is what it's like flying in the air, you know, you can come experience it. It's something that those nymphs have to experience for themselves, right? And in the same way with our practice, these results, the results of appropriate attention, the results of practicing, they're something that people can talk about. The Buddha can talk about them to us. But to actually know them, we have to become like that dragonfly itself, you know? We have to actually experience it. You know, we actually have to experience appropriate attention. We actually have to experience the good and bad results of our practice. We actually have to experience that we have the ability to choose. We have the ability to cultivate our minds. But the benefit of all this is that when we do this correctly, when we attend appropriately, we develop a skill. And we develop a confidence. We develop the ability to take responsibility for ourselves, to take care of ourselves, to take care of our actions, like those young men who go out on the vision quest. And they come back to their communities, they know that they're a person who can contribute. They're a person who's seen what they can do with the skills they have. So this is a possibility for all of us. It starts with sitting down to watch our breath. It starts with doing wholesome actions, and it grows. It grows into a skill. It grows into a knowledge of how to train our own minds. It grows into a knowledge of how to make ourselves happy. It grows into something that when we come back to our communities after meditating, it spreads out into them, even though it's in our own minds, you know? And it grows into these things, but it ends in a happiness that doesn't change, which is something beyond words. Kind of like the dragonfly who's left the water, now flying in the air, something that can only be experienced. But it's something that we can experience for ourselves, provided that we keep going and that we practice. Okay? So I think I'll leave that for your reflection.